Our next guest, Tracker Dan, lifelong survivalist, tracker, legendary knife maker, Navy SEAL, friend, and above all else, brother. I hope you enjoy this conversation. You're at the school, you're also getting exposed to people that have their own kind of backgrounds. You've talked in the past about getting experience, Filipino martial artist, this is the 90s. So it's just like the golden era of like American Filipino martial arts. Some people are coming to the school to basically train the specialty of survival, but they're coming in there with their own kind of like backgrounds.
Oh yeah.
So are you getting like cross pollination from people showing up there?
Yeah. It was amazing, you know, being a caretaker there and then an instructor after. The people you meet and the experiences they've had, like, you know, they're
who's showing up. Like, what are you learning?
I just anything and everything. Like, because there'd be someone who'd show up that was a game guide, you know, and so just the experiences he had with packing, you know, mules and different things like that, and that's just something that came to mind. But just everything from medical advice from doctors that show up and can know how to apply medical procedures to a more primitive type situation, and you know, the book recommendations that you learn from, you know, people who've been in third world countries providing medical aid and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, learning how to make your own silver colloidal, you know, and treat Lyme disease and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, definitely lots of people from different martial arts backgrounds. So one of the base things they taught during the Apache classes was, you know, Tom felt that Apache Wolverine fighting was very similar to some of the Filipino stuff he saw from students that came through. So he had.
Can you describe what was being shown as far as like an Apache inspired or like an Apache base? Like, what are you doing with blades? What's the philosophy there?
I think it was kept pretty basic. I always wanted to go deeper, you know, and learn more from Tom, but you know, he can be a hard one to
access,
a hard nut to crack kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of our stuff was that the people that come in and teach was Minnesota Collie Group, you know, so very Dan and Asano, JKD type thing. And, you know, they're keeping it simple so that, you know, the empty hand stuff translates to the bladed stuff, translates to the stick stuff. So, you know, I know sticks are going to be more for impact weapons and take more strength and be for joints and different things like that and bones, whereas the blade, you know, you're looking for the softer.
Any place with stuff. Any place with a V pattern on it, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. One of the, we've had a few people come on here who had some sort of interaction or some sort of influence or inspiration by Sony Umpad.
Yeah.
Sony Umpad. Maestro Sony Umpad.
Yeah.
I've trained with two of his students. I never got to meet him, but we've had Josh Burnett, you know, had some inspiration and kind of like a connection with that, and I've trained under Maya. Like every time I could, manage to get there, like a sword fight in her backyard, I've learned a lot from her. Like out of all the Filipino American instructors that I've seen out there, as far as the students they produced, and some of them, I haven't managed to see anybody as kind of detailed orientated as Sony Umpad.
Yeah.
You got to interact.
Yes. So one of the students coming through the tracker school, who I ended up going and hanging out with from time to time, introduced me to Sunny Ungpod. And so I loved his projectile stuff.
So for people that don't know him, Sony was, he was a gangster.
Yeah.
And yes, he had a system or a style, but he, like, he could make weapons out of anything, right? So yeah. Like, what projectiles was he kind of showcasing and kind of?
So he got me into bicycle spokes and umbrella tines.
That's ghetto as shit.
I know.
And bicycle spokes.
And like he said, you know, when I throw knives on my little patio here, you know, it clangs when it falls out or doesn't stick and bothers the neighbors. So he was like, use these bicycle spokes because they don't make a lot of noise.
And they'll stick.
Yeah, and you can use them like a shotgun pattern, like throwing a handful of them. Yeah, and apparently, you know, he was explaining how the Filipinos would use wooden spikes the same way for fish, you know, in shallow water, like just making, pinning them to the ground and making a cage around them kind of thing.
So it's basically a survival skill or just a basic life skill.
Yeah.
That's being converted into, like, I'm going to...
Or throwing it into a flock of birds, you know, like, yeah. So it's just amazing, simple stuff. And, you know, like being able to, like, run through the woods and cut a bunch of, you know, branches as you go, you know, like just doing 45s on each end. So now you got a handful of projectiles if you're being pursued, that kind of thing. And and then towards the late 90s, the times I got to interact with them, because it was just short little periods here and there. And I brought them like back a bullwhip, made out of kangaroo hide from Australia. And because he uses that as a training tool for learning projectiles from different angles. And
so Sony's, like, Maya has a lot of his old training tools.
Yeah.
And there are some ingenious things.
Oh.
And he would make everything. Like, yeah. When I made my first Panuti sword, like training Panuti.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I have to honor his memory.
Yeah.
So I stole a stop sign somewhere and just cut a sword out of it, an aluminum sword out of it. But his whole philosophy when it came to showing people and training was like, do it yourself, make your tools, and if it's not optimal, you make what could be optimal.
Yeah,
so like he has a training sword with two arrow shafts.
Hmm.
And it's made for you, for students to be precise, so where they put sword through.
Nice.
It's genius stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
He's, again, like, well, if people don't know a lot about him, they should research him. He's probably one of the...
And towards the late 90s time when I was starting to... I was going to be departing the tracker school to go, you know, become a frogman. I would ask him, like, you know, as far as, because some of this stuff is just so intricate and, like, would take years to master.
I mean, he was a dancer.
Yeah.
So he could move.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. It seems very complex and flow-like, the way they're kind of, like.
Yeah. But I would be, like, focused on, or, like, he would focus more on teaching me, like, if you needed to train some of your guys, you know, you've run out of bullets and, you know, it's going to be down to blades. Like, you know, you had 10 minutes to just kind of give them a way to protect themselves and do the most damage. You know, so he's teaching me that kind of stuff. And just real practical, simple, effective.
He was a gangster. Was he smoking as he was kind of showing you some of the stuff? Again, I never met him, but I've, like, a lot of the videos I've seen him, he's like the coolest character.
Just
cigar in one hand.
Yeah.
You know.
He's got that leather cuff on to cover his old colors because apparently repercussions would.
But again, he's one of the most underappreciated, I think, instructors out there. There's a lot of big names, a lot of famous names in the Filipino martial arts world.
Yeah.
But again, just my perspective that I'm seeing, he's pretty, pretty underappreciated one. You're learning from all these different influences there, you know. You're getting exposed to people like Sony Umpad and some amazing people coming in with different experiences. The approach, the tracker school, and as far as a movie, like a movie is being filmed and it's going to have an influence or it's going to be based on some of the experiences of Tom Brown. Right? This is the Hunted movie.
Yeah.
While this was going on, are people talking about the fact that they're going to work on this movie? Is there anticipation? What's the feeling around this opportunity, I guess, to kind of like put some of this information out into the masses?
Yeah. We were just trying to, you know, Benicio came out and we were trying to show him as much of the skills that...
So Benicio Del Toro plays this former SF guy in this movie where he, you know, goes off the rails but he has basically his background and training is based on basically what you're kind of basically training on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he shows up and you get to train Benicio for some of the stuff that goes on in this movie.
Yeah. And like, you know, I was showing tree travel, like where we climb up in the tree and then bend it over to another tree and grab and
so you don't leave any tracks on the ground.
No tracks. You know, it's kind of anticlimactic after you see Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, which had just come out I think recently. So, you know, everybody's got to compete with that, you know, so you can't do anything realistic per se. And showing different martial arts stuff and that kind of thing that would possibly be used in the movie.
Yeah. How was he as far as somebody learned?
He was great. He just really laid back and he was really into it, you know, and yeah, great, great guy.
This movie basically showcased a lot of Benicio Del Toro was like this damaged individual that went through some shit in war. And you had the character of Tommy Lee Jones being this mentor teacher figure.
Yeah.
That was based on Tom.
Yeah. Yeah, because he'd done that in the past.
He would help. He helped with tracking and...
For different groups, yeah. And then, you know, this one guy ended up going off the rails and I think he killed his family and stuff like that. And Tom had to track him down and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is basically...
I think it's in one of Tom's books, like the real story.
So he's basically... This is basically now... And this is before the internet. It's a way that this school and what it shows people and some of the elements of the school, like yourself, are now being cast out into the masses. Now there's this giant interest now for like, hey, hold on, I wanna have a knife like that one, I guess, this tracker knife, which I personally am not a fan of, but you know, some people out there could be fans of.
Well, you know, his first design, I've seen the sketches. It's
smaller.
Well, you could make it
whatever size you want.
Yeah. But the angles were much better. Like the tip is in line with the handle.
Yeah.
And that chopping edge is much more in line with how you would chop, in my opinion.
If you were a crazy former spec op guy and you had to run around the city and shit like that, would you carry around that big-ass spatula behind your back?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to get that out of the way because that was my biggest point of contention with that movie.
Yeah.
It's an interesting kind of like window, a fictional window, but into that kind of like skill set and mindset that not a lot of us had seen kind of portrayed in that way. And I think it inspired a lot of people to both either learn a little bit more about that. You know, it probably inspired a lot of people to learn about knife fighting and just utilizing knives as weaponry as well. But for me, it was the whole aspect of like, hey, it's just me, and let me figure out what I can make that I could need in this environment. That yeah. I think that's what it kind of, it made me go and find some of his books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And later on, it made me track you down.
Yeah.
But you have this experience at the school now is like world famous. It already was, but it's famous now in a different way.
Yeah.
Are you seeing the difference being there?
When did that movie come out?
I don't know, 97, 98,
yeah.
maybe, somewhere around that time.
Yeah. I don't know, because we'd always had military guys coming through.
Yeah.
You know, ever since I was there. And, yeah, I mean, I the classes did get really big.
Not how big? Like, how many people would show up to a class?
Some classes were 165 people.
That's
I mean,
a concert. That's yeah, a private concert.
It was insane. Like, and, you know, you could have them range anywhere from, like, 65 people to 165. You know, it was, yeah.
Where's your mindset at this point? Are you thinking about remaining? Like, what do you want to do with your life while you're there, while all this is going on?
So, yeah, when I'd always, because my dad was from Vietnam and different things, or even my stepdad, I got interested in, you know, Green Berets, like, when I was real young kind of thing, and I thought that be awesome, you know, it'd be like modern ninja Indian scout type stuff. But then when I was 14, I learned about the SEALs, and it just seemed like the toughest man challenge, you know.
What were you reading about the SEALs? Are you reading about Vietnam era SEALs? Like, what are you looking at that inspires you to get into that community? This is before the concept of them now is
where, yeah,
like, there's books and stuff like that out there, but this is before all that.
It just seemed like the hardest rite of passage I had heard about. And Marcinko's books, you know, were real inspiration.
Red Cells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this was one of those things that I gave up for God kind of thing. Like, you know, the pastors and all that. My dad even talked me out of doing that. And I'm glad they did, because then I got the tracker school experience, because the skills I learned there, I wouldn't have had time to learn.
This is most of your 20s at that school.
Yeah. So when I was 25, I went in 95, I went to the tracker school.
Yeah.
And so after being there for a while and learning all this stuff, you know, it becomes like Groundhog Day in a lot of ways. It's just, you're turning and burning all the time, because we kept, even when you had weeks off, we'd squeeze another class in or something like that. And, I'm getting close to 30, and, you know, I notice, like, I'm not keeping my edge like I want, you know, and I wanted to test this stuff out in life or death situations. And I'd wanted to be a SEAL since I was 14, you know, and we had plenty of SEALs coming through. And so, you know, I asked...
Were you asking them, like, hey?
I finally did. I was like, yeah, could the teams use a guy like me? And guys, and I was saying it jokingly, because I'm 30 at the time. And he said, yeah, just get an age waiver. That was Mike Jaco.
Just get an age waiver.
Yeah.
It sounds, yeah, it's easy. Just go through Buzz.
Because the cutoff, I think, was either 26 or 28. Like, it shifts, you know, depending on who's in command. But, yeah, so.
So you say, you know what? This sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the politics of the school were starting to wear on me, you know, too. They go through a lot of caretakers and a lot of instructors over the years.
And so you decide to join the Navy.
Yeah. Yep. So I had braces on at the time when I had asked him. So, I got those taken off. And by the time I could get in, I was 31. And by the time I was 32, I was going through buds.
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also supports some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
So for people that don't know what a medical waiver is, like, can you explain that? An age waiver. You're going through buds at 32.
Yeah.
Which is not that common, can we safely say?
Yeah, it's uncommon that there was a couple guys that were a year or two older than me, but they didn't make it through Hell Week.
Yeah.
And I've heard of the oldest guy going through was 38. And
shout out to whoever that specimen is.
Yeah, totally.
So you're like, and when you're there, are you getting like looks? Are you getting like?
They called me grandpa or pops. Yeah.
Preparation-wise, how are you preparing for this?
So I had a lot of good advice from the SEALs who were coming through tracker school.
What's their advice? Give us some of that. Maybe somebody is listening to this.
Get the heaviest boots on you can and find the softest sand you can and punish yourself. Get used to soft sand.
Get used basically. To soft sand.
Yeah, because it sucks. It just sucks the energy out of you.
Yeah.
Also, dropping throughout the day and doing 50 push-ups, having a pull-up bar nearby, knocking out as many pull-ups as you can, knocking out as many sit-ups as you can. And I was surprised because I was like 165 before I started doing that stuff. But they were saying knock this stuff out as many times as you can throughout the day and eat. You got to eat. And I'd never been able to put on weight. Like, I look like a skinned squirrel, like great muscle definition. But once I started doing this, I put on 10 pounds. And, I thought you'd lean out more, all that kind of and all the running and stuff. I thought, you'd lose muscle, but.
You're putting on.
Yeah, and eating was a big thing.
So you get there.
Yeah.
You present your waiver. Get called grandpa, a few times, I guess, imagine. does that affect your confidence in any way? Or are you just set?
No, and...
Because it's like, mindset-wise, I get it's like a
mindset
thing.
And some people say it's more mind. It's both. It's mind and body. Like, I couldn't have trained too hard for what I went through. Like... You don't want to train to the point where you injure yourself, but I should have trained harder. you know what I mean?
You were not ready.
Well, nobody is, but...
But you were...
It's...
Yeah.
It's brutal what they put you through, so...
You like, we talked about this before. Like, you mentioned that, everybody... you get, like, equipment through to go through this. Like, and they issue knives.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, this is like kind of nice, specific conversation. What knives are they issuing to you guys as you go through this training? Because the knives get checked, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you have inspections all the time, like before every dive, or not dive, but like ocean swim. So everything gets inspected for sand, rust, sharpness.
You have to keep everything functional.
Yeah. So someone had a bright idea to, you know, issue cold steel SRKs. It's kind of a bush blade, but it's carbon steel and it rusts if you look at it sideways.
And you're taking it into the ocean.
Yeah. And, you know, it's got that powder coating paint on it, so it protects most of the blade.
But not the edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are people not keeping these? How are people keeping them from rusting?
So people put Vaseline behind their ear or have chapstick up their wetsuit sleeve or something like that, so they can, after they get the inspection done, they can coat it, you know. And, you know, there was a couple Mark III, I think it's a Mark III dive knife floating around. So those are stainless.
Older,
and, yeah. And they got a history to them, you know, and I like the blade shape a lot better. It's very piercy. So I did some drug deals to score one of those. But, you know, carbon steel, I think you can get an edge on easier than stainless, you know, depending on the type of stainless it is. But
yes, you're constantly being tested. Everything has to be clean. Everything has to be orientated. Are you taking, I imagine you're taking mental notes like, this knife sheath sucks. This, I would rather this happen.
Yeah.
So is this kind of like a part of the inception of you going into like, hey, maybe I need to make something that doesn't exist?
Well, yes, definitely. But that's been since I had my first knife when I was 6, like always, you know, changing making a sheath that is more for where I want to carry it and how I want to deploy it, or modifying edges to be, you know, less obtuse, you know, so they cut better. Profiles, so they're pointier for piercing better. And then the stuff they issued us once we got to the teams, it very, you know, like the sheaths at then were just, you know, these big quarter inch rivets, you know, it takes up too much space. You got all this gear. You go through
buds.
Yeah.
Once, right?
Yeah.
Why not twice?
I didn't want to prove that I was extra tough.
So you went through
do it right the first time.
You went through buds the first time around.
If you're gonna be stupid, you better be tough.
You pass on your first try.
Yeah,
which is not easy, I imagine. And also, you're doing it, you know, at a not the most preferred age. You come out the other end of that, and you start getting issued equipment, and you start going through other forms of the rest of the training aspect of it. And you mentioned that the quality of the gear or some of the stuff you're getting just doesn't make any sense. Like, what knife are you getting issued?
It was a SOG seal pup. Great blade. You know, like throwing them like without breaking tips. You know, But the carry systems on most stuff is just leaves a lot to be desired.
It's like half the value of a knife is a sheath.
I think it's more. Like, I would rather have a $200 sheath and a $5 knife than the other way around.
Yeah, which is a different philosophy. Like, I hadn't heard anybody kind of talk about that before you did, you know, like our interactions.
Yeah, because it's got to be where you need it, when you need it, and be able to put it away easily so you can do the next thing depending on the situation. So yeah,
this whole aspect of having, I mean, it's an essential first line item, you know?
Like, yeah.
And you're about to be working in an environment where it's just you guys being sent off to do God knows what, and God knows where, and like supply is going to be probably an issue. You're not going to be able to just go to Walmart and buy another knife, you know? You're taking your whole kind of life experiences around making your own tools, modifying, tinkering with sheaths, systems like that, and you start making knives and other types of tools as well.
Yeah.
During your time while you're going through this process preparing.
Yeah, yeah. And I started off making optimal carry systems for the stuff I was issued.
Yeah, so basically they would give you this knife and they would give you this floppy nylon whatever or Kydex.
Or a Kydex sheath that's got shoulders on it that the tip wants to catch on. You know, like the only sheath I've seen that doesn't do that is that one that, you know, the Hisatsu or something where you can put the back edge on the thing and it'll line it up with the groove for the blade, you know. Otherwise,
shout out to James Williams.
Yeah.
Because the Hisatsu, yeah.
So I thought that was ingenious, but from my experience overseas, getting a blade out to use it for something and not being able to put it away when you're in the dark, because you can't turn on a light and you've got to get your gun back up fast.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of you holding something, taking something out, cutting it or ripping it open, and then saying, hold on, whatever's over here, let me just fiddle with this sheath to try and put this back.
Right, yeah.
Is not a good thing.
Yeah, so that, and you know, Kydex wasn't a big thing. Like, I know I dabbled with it probably in the late 90s. But it wasn't easy to come by or know how to work it the best. And so I just kept on, like, there'd be times like when the seals were coming through and they'd have some issued blade, that just horrible retention, you know, everything. And like over the coals of the fire, I'm heating it up and making adjustments and taking a hot wire and poking holes and then saddle stitching with wire through so it can cut off all those rivets, you know, and make it small and concealable. And
yeah, I remember you showed me like a cold steel dagger.
Yeah.
That was kind of like that, basically modified in that way.
Yeah. I whether it's on your gear or concealable, like, you don't have room for a sheath that's 3 times wider than the blade. Like, it'd make a great boat paddle, but it's not... It's unnecessary. Like, yeah.
So you're filling this weird void there as far as like, hey, why has nobody come up with a optimal carry sheath system for a knife, and why has nobody come up with something about this size and why that size? So basically, you're viewing the problem not only from the maker perspective and just somebody that's been doing this their whole lives, but now as an operator, the operator perspective that you're now getting, and also having a bunch of operators that are going out there testing their shit and coming back with like, hey, Dan, can you fix this part of the knife? Because it's kind of digging into me, and you're getting that live, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's... And, you know, I've had a lot of people try and replicate my stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, so I've taken stuff out there, you know, that I've seen and experienced and kind of, like, matched and mixed for the thing that solves my problems that I want to solve. And I would just encourage people to, like, hey, you like stuff on mine? Like, well, how does that, and make it better, like, instead of trying to just replicate it? Because if you try and replicate something and you don't understand why it's that way, you're not going to do a good replication, for one.
It's just going to be a knockoff.
Yeah, and, like, get some experience and make your blade around that experience. That's where you come up with the great new ideas. And like, it took forever for people to really understand,
get it,
why I put so much time into the carry system.
Yeah,
because everybody's looking at the blade, and it's like, you know, it finally caught on. Like, oh,
do you have a blood shark on you, right?
Yeah,
let's pull that out. Yeah, that's cool.
It's got one of Kelly's hand sprayed cheese on it.
That's cool.
Yeah,
maybe I'll give it back. I don't know yet. So, like, for people not just listening to us instead of watching us, the fact that you can put this knife into the sheath without looking and just have everything guiding you into where it needs to be, and also the fact that you can do this ambidextrously was something that I didn't know about. I bought one of these from you when there wasn't a line out the door yet.
Yeah.
We'll talk about how I found you. But I remember having the experience of, I didn't know that you can put them in that way because I wasn't that bright, I guess, or I didn't read
the description. Most you can't, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember just taking this knife out, cutting a giant bale of weed somewhere in Baja, and then just nonchalantly putting it back into the sheath. And I knew about edge orientation, and just I remember just putting it the wrong way. I knew it was the wrong way, but it fit, and then I was like, huh. Like, wait, it was the wrong way. And I was like, oh, this thing can go both ways. And it's such a small, dumb thing, I guess, detail, I guess, but it changes everything. It's like you realize how valuable this thing is. And also, you're running around out there, jumping over stuff, getting in and out of things, and this thing just goes flying off, and now you have a very expensive sheath. So the innovation aspect of that and how you got to figure some of that out is pretty fascinating. You eventually deploy. Can you talk to a little bit about your experience deploying now as a...
Yeah. So we have long workups, you know, year and a half of training before we go out the door. And, of course, they changed our whole mission profile.
Yeah, this is 9/11. This is 9/11 era.
Now. Yeah, yeah.
You were going in with a different, you know, like this. All this stuff is kind of like happening as you're going through your process of joining and figuring out your place and learning your.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They're switching everything around, basically.
Yeah, the damn neck. Guys got tasked with guarding Karzai in Afghanistan. So then they thought, you know, they did such a good job and he was facing lots of threats. You know, let's have, you know, SEAL teams on all the top five interim government, you know, in Iraq. And so they gave us 2 weeks of Secret Service training.
Yeah, it's funny. So basically, I mean, you guys are training to be, you know, SEALs and the traditional role that the SEALs had.
Yeah.
And now this new...
Now we're going to be standing on the X.
Yeah.
Instead of creating the X.
Yeah. So you basically take a crash course in bodyguarding for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Which is even less than I had. And you're off to,
yeah.
You say, you know, you're the role that you're now going to adapt is completely outside of what you were kind of getting ready for, I guess. You know, because being a bodyguard is very different.
Yeah.
Than, you know, I'm going to go off and do some direct action stuff or other aspects of that functionality. Now you're going to be basically waiting for something to happen and react.
Yeah.
How's that? What does that do to your nervous system?
You know, with the training that we go through, like, real life is so much slower.
Yeah.
In most cases. You know, there's sometimes that real life exceeds, but rare. You know, with all the training we'd had previously, you know, the 2 weeks, I think, was sufficient just to get us more professional, so you know how to stand in a polo shirt and
yeah. If you know what like bodyguarding entails, now when we were learning how to bodyguard people in a war zone, which is Mexico,
yeah,
we went to the SEALs to learn some of this, and some of the people that were showing us were people probably coming back from some of those experiences and these new roles that they were adapting over there.
Yeah, well, and we did get some training from the Damnik guys. From their experience with Karzai and that, which was great, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, you're just making little adjustments to how you're going to carry a long gun, if you're even carrying one, because a lot of times it's just a sidearm. And
but you're doing advanced work, which for people that don't know what that is, you're a bodyguarding team. You will usually have an advance element or a group of people that will go and check out a venue or an environment before your VIP gets there. But you're the first ones to get there and the last ones to leave, and it's usually a very small group of you.
Yeah.
And this is an active battle zone.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, and our guy was the prime minister. Ayad Alawi. Yeah, I mean, this guy was a serious cat. He had an assassination attempt way back in the day. I don't know if it was Saddam was trying to assassinate him or something, but he took two axe blows to the chest and survived. And so this guy basically ran the country. The president and all that was just figureheads. And he needed to go to places that we should not have taken him.
So as an advanced element, you're going to check out a place where he's going to meet with people.
Yeah.
And all these fuckers are armed.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially once he gets there, because, you know, it's all these tribal leaders in different areas and, you know, or mob bosses of this block or area of Baghdad. And, once he got there, like, everybody wants to help. And so everybody has a gun. Like, you know, you're trained to look for the hands. And it's like you couldn't find a set of hands without a gun in them. And then guys are coming up to him, you know, with a gun in their hand. And they're just, like, just so emotional, like, for, you know, the family member they lost. And, you know, and we're just like.
Any gun going off into the air for celebration when you get there? Are you warning them? It's like, dude, don't shoot your guns out.
Well, there was these guys in ski masks. So we're locked onto them. And it's like they're just the interpreters, like nobody told us, you know, that don't want to get their heads cut off when they go back to town, you know.
And, yeah.
It was crazy. And, like, I'd pop up on the rooftop with my sniper rifle and, you know, I'm seeing, like, a truckload of militant-type guys in the alleyway behind this place where he's in coming down, and I'm, like, letting my OIC and everybody know. And they unass from the vehicle, like 30 of them, and just start going through the buildings and clearing the buildings on, you know, that backside. No communication whatsoever. You know,
they're doing you a favor, but but doesn't look like it.
I don't know who they were or if they were doing us a favor.
Did they wave at you from the other building? Like, yay.
I'm getting ready to duck or return fire, but, like, it's just like, what the hell is going on? Yeah, or, you know, a mortar lands 5 minutes before we get to a place and we don't have time for EOD to come in and make sure, you know, like, it didn't go off. But we got to, you know, get this guy to see the people he's got to see to get reelected, kind of thing. And so, anyway.
Yeah. What does this experience do for you, like, for you generally? Like, what are you learning there as far as your gear, your equipment? Also, like, you know, some of the stuff that you later make for other people. Like, what are you learning as you go through this weird-ass experience?
So with that stuff, like, the main thing I learned is doing Secret Service work is boring as hell. Because it's either there's nothing going on and you're trying to stay awake, or everything's going on. And
at the same time, and you have to mind everything.
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely designed my karambit around, like, being able to have that on my midline and be loaded up with that, you know, so my support hand can come out and respond while my pistol's coming out. And so the carry system for that, where you're not getting jammed, like most karambit sheaths, you get jammed up in them if you got to pull them under duress, kind of thing.
So you're tinkering as you're there. You're modifying shit as you're there. Like, did you bring any, like, knife making equipment with you, or, like?
No, because I wasn't getting, you know,
serious about
everything
it.
I'd done up to that stage was just modifying stuff, that
customizing stuff for this guy over here.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a cool sheet, Dan. I'll make you one. That's where you're at with.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah. And
is it when you came back? Is that
well? And so that was the bodyguarding aspect. Like, that we did that half the time we were over there. The other half was we're, you know, kicking down doors and grabbing IED makers and running convoys and doing sniper overwatch missions and stuff like that. And anytime he was out of town during that first 3 months, you know, those of us who didn't go with him would get farmed out to different teams and do overwatch for the Army and stuff like that. So, so there was a lot of tactical learning over there too, as far as the carry systems and stuff that I brought with me and what I needed to modify and whatnot. But, and you know, I learned real quickly that, you know, like people had come to me with their snowflake blade and want a carry system for it. And you got to make a mold for that blade to try and get it to be ambidextrous. And not all blades work ambidextrous, depending on the guard, the shape of the blade, and the time involved in making a mold for one snowflake. You know, you feel bad charging a couple hundred dollars and you're still not recouping the time you put into it.
Yeah, because you basically had to make your, like, I've seen you make, like, I'm going to make a mold for this knife. You whittle it in, like, a wood mold, basically.
Yeah.
So you have to whittle the shape of this knife with wood or with whatever material you have there. So it's, like, a very complex process.
Yeah.
But you're learning what shapes work, though.
Exactly. And that, you know, I finally decided, you know, instead of doing the snowflake blades, just make the optimal blade for the carry system that I designed. So, yeah, that's where the Blood Shark came from.
So you come back from this experience. You find a need against them, a need for something, I guess. Well, I mean, people are asking about what you carry. People are seeing some of these tools pop up in different hands and people out there are utilizing some of your concepts already. Some people are ripping you off.
Yeah, and I got into a knife Scientology cult. And so
a knife Scientology cult.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we'd go down and train the damn neck guys in knife stuff, and I would make my Blood Shark for them with trainers and sheath that would fit both, you know, kind of thing.
So the some of the first Blood Sharks that you were actually selling to people, you were making for people, that you were making for some of the Danmanic guys that you were involved with as far as training.
Yeah.
And I imagine, and Danmanic, I don't know, development group, dev group,
research and development, yeah.
Yeah, so basically these guys are getting scalps out there, you know. These are people that are going out there and direct action shit.
Tier 1 spec ops, naval special warfare.
So they're going out there and doing things like bad breath level stuff, I mean, in some places, I guess. Yeah. So they're coming back to you with experience.
Yeah.
Like, of a kind that not even you had got to see directly.
Yeah, because, like, when I was first making them, like, I was trying to keep the cost down and make it as thin as possible. So I was, like, going and letting the Linex truck bed liner guys let me spray the handles and get the texture on them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And one of the... good friend of mine, but one of the frogs said, "Hey, could you wrap this with cord?" And so
with paracord.
Yeah.
And this is like, again, time wise, paracord wrapped handles were shitty as fuck back then. Like not nobody did cool wrapped handles out of paracord. I think as Hartsfield is the only one that I remember kind of like having something that was comparable or at least cool, but you can get that shit. It's like unobtainable.
Yeah.
And they only made a few.
And I liked the Strider wraps.
Yeah.
Strider
was making some stuff early on.
Yeah.
But a lot of the companies that were bootlegging that stuff just didn't give a shit about it. And you could, the wrapping would move or unravel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, in the late 90s, I was rewrapping trainer handles, you know, that had that slippery, crappy, loose wrap. And I've been tying knots since I was a little kid, you know, just because my dad was teaching me all that stuff and I got the bug for it. And so that, you know, late 90s is when I came up with this double ridge wrap.
Can I just so people can see it, I guess. What camera, Albie? That one? So this gutted paracord that has been, because I've seen you make these, how long does that take you?
With the shroom cap, we're talking a couple hours.
Yeah, I've seen you make these and then having your hands look like the guy from My Left Foot, you know?
Yeah.
It's basically gutted paracord. Each time you're twining it up,
you got to keep that pressure on the whole time so it doesn't get sloppy.
So it's a workout.
Yeah.
And the knotting you do basically creates two ridges on both sides of the blade, and that shroom cap that you call, it's basically a good brace for your thumb or your palm.
And it gives you a sideways pinching for being able to deploy and
pull it out, different ways of gripping it.
Yeah.
But that just wrapping and handmade option for just having something in your hand's going to be secure is like, nobody's done that before that I've been able to kind of spot in this way.
And you know, it came from the lock stitch my mother taught me for making moccasins, so that if the cord ever gets cut, it doesn't unravel because it's trapped underneath itself with each wrap. So
you're spending 2 hours on the handle. How much time are you spending on this on a Kydex sheath for that hand for that knife?
It's with the ambidextrous fitting and getting the tension right. You're looking at over an hour.
So we're almost at 4 hours now. What about grinding depending on the type?
Because I've seen the type of grind and the heat.
Yeah, because I've seen you grind SM100 titanium ones of those, and that takes a bit longer. But
So
the final piece of this that I don't think people know that much about, I guess, is this guy, the clip.
Yeah.
Now these clips are pretty widespread as far as the bootleg versions of this. There's a few companies out there making this specific type of clip.
Yeah.
Now, what makes your clip, like, what makes it your, like, what went into this? Because I remember seeing, like, early versions of this online.
Yeah.
And then when I actually went to your shop and I saw ones that you had made, you were utilizing, like the clips were like a police badge or something like that, I think, remember. One of them that you showed me was, like, modified from something like that.
There was some real wide ones like that did have a cloth grabber, and I would cut them down to make them more narrow. But
that slowly kind of told you, like, hey, I should just make.
Yeah, yeah. The amount of time I put into cutting those down and reshaping them and then getting them parkerized and that kind of stuff.
Now, why would you want a cloth grabber instead of a belt loop or... I don't know, like a malice. I don't know why would you want a cloth grabber?
So with my, you know, thoughts, you know, as far as lifestyle and just the way I want to be is always prepared, ready to go kind of thing. So, you know, if you got to put on a gun belt and fish loops through and stuff like that, and stuff's going to get left behind if it's not quick and easy. And same with boots, you know, if you got to lace everything up, you know, like, so I wanted something I could throw in my front pocket.
Clip it on.
I wanted something that I could sleep with, you know, on my boxers or, you know, when you're overseas in the shower, I wanted to be able to clip it to my watch band because you never know when the shit's going to go down. So always have something ready. And, you know, a lot of people just can't, that's paranoid. And but hey, I'd rather have it and not need it.
Yeah, it's an essential tool. I mean, that's one of the main things I show people how to create when I show people how to like go into a non-permissive environment or going somewhere where it's kind of dangerous is one of the easiest things you can manufacture or access as far as a weapon is a pointed object.
And when we're on the water or under the water, we always have an edge. And it's not for underwater knife fighting. It can be.
Yeah.
But it's to cut you free from stuff that's going to drag you down or keep you from getting to air, you know. So, yeah, it's, you know, there's medical management. There's cutting restraints. Or if you're rescuing somebody, cutting them free from restraints. You know, like it's not all about making holes in people. So.
Yeah, but it's a pretty good idea to always have that capability.
Yeah.
Because security is part of it.
Yes.